Thank you for the opportunity to share with you a little bit about my work with healthcare promoters and midwives. I've worked with Concern America and the Catholic Church for the past 14 years, training health promoters and midwives in Guatemala. And as I began to research what health promoters are doing in other parts of the world, I realized that there was very little written on health promoters as practitioners or providing primary care services in their communities. And so I decided to conduct this study as this descriptive study to give baseline data about the work of health promoters being trained by Concern America in Guatemala. Due to the long history of security issues within the country and our desire to protect both our patients and the health promoters who work with us, we do not keep any records or written charts in the clinics. All of the health records are kept by the patients, and then they bring them into the consult. And we take the security measures so seriously that I personally don't know the last names of many of the health promoters who I've worked with for many, many years. Let's see. This is my disclosure statement. I've been a long-term volunteer with Concern America, which is the agency through which this study was conducted. So just to show you, this is a slide of Guatemala, and there, can you see the pointer? Okay, so this is the country of Guatemala, and Petén, which is the area that I work, is all of this top part of the country. And right here, this is Flores, oops, and that is the urban center of the department or the state. In Petén, although it's roughly one-third of the country in area, has a very low population. It's largely rural and it's very isolated. There's been a very large population growth over the past 10 years, 75% increase in the area. And in this slide, I'm just looking at population per physician, and so there are several countries there to compare with: Cuba, the U.S., Mexico, and Salvador. In Guatemala as a country, there's 1,111 people per physician, but in Petén, which is very isolated, as I said, it's 5,000 per physician, and most of those physicians or healthcare providers, healthcare professionals, are located in the urban center. And so the area where our work is concentrated, which is largely rural, it includes the municipalities of Sayache, La Libertad, and Las Cruces. There's a population of approximately 330,000 people, and there are 12 physicians in that area. And so that comes out to roughly 27,500 physicians per physician, excuse me. So within this context, Concern America has partnered with the Catholic Church to train health promoter practitioners to address the common health needs in the community. And these are community volunteers with an average of second to fourth grade education level. And they go through training courses. Each course is 1 week long, and they're every 2 months. So we do six courses a year over the course of 3 years. After a promoter has finished that training course, many of those promoters go on to be what we call multipliers, because they multiply the work. And so those promoters then begin training and supervising other health promoters in the area. And so although this study focuses on the primary care services that are provided, our work actually encompasses many other areas as well, including training midwives and women's health promoters, environmental health promoters, oral health promoters, and we do a lot in community organization. So our primary care services are part of a comprehensive community health program in the area. So in this descriptive study, I went to clinics and used patient interviews to evaluate scope of practice, affordability, safety, effectiveness, and patient perceptions of the primary care services being provided by the health promoters. I went to 3 different clinics. I went 2 days to each clinic, so it was a total of 6 days. And my study design and the interview questions were all approved by Eastern Mennonite University's internal review board. So there were a total of 129 patients seen, and this just gives a breakdown of the information that I was able to receive. I did follow-up phone interviews, which were done 1 to 3 weeks after the initial consult, and only 94 patients, it was about 75%, I was able to get a response from. Some of them did not have phones, and some of them did not answer the phone at the phone number that they provided to me. So as part of the results, I was looking at scope of practice, and in order to get at this, I wrote down all of the diagnoses that were provided by the health promoters for each of the consults. And so the top 12 most frequent diagnoses are listed here in terms of their percentage. There were 166 diagnoses, and so these percentages are based on those diagnoses because several patients had multiple issues going on. For example, they had malaria and a urinary tract infection, or diabetes and hypertension. And so you can see there's kind of a mixture there of some quote-unquote tropical medicine and also a lot of issues that are dealt with in more developed countries as well. On this slide, you can see the additional diagnoses that were dealt with by the health promoters on those days. And for each of these diagnoses, there was 1, 2, or 3 patients that were seen that had these issues. So there were a total of 42 different health issues that were addressed on those 6 clinic days. And all of these patients were either treated or they were referred to other health centers because obviously things like ruling out appendicitis, rectal bleeding, those are not issues that the health promoters are trained to take care of. So as we look at safety, there are several things that are built into our program to try to ensure patient safety, which is something that we take very seriously. One of those things is, for example, we work off of a very small list of medications, which are essential medicines as defined by the World Health Organization. And by limiting the number of medications that health promoters use, it helps because they have fewer things to remember and interactions to remember. Another thing that I think is really important with the safety issue is that health promoters are able to use more medications as they show competency. So, for example, we do a course on diabetes, even though they may pass the test, that doesn't automatically mean they have access to all of the medicines that we use for diabetes. They have to show competency to the person who is precepting them in their work. So I looked at safety in 4 different ways, and the first thing was to look at the diagnoses and the treatment to see if the health promoters were following the protocols that we'd established as an organization. And because I'm not a clinical specialist, this was also double-checked by another coworker of mine who actually does most of the designing of the protocols. And so I found one error in protocol in the 166 treatments, and that was penicillin given 3 times a day instead of 4 times a day. Following that, I did a visual inspection of the medications to make sure that what the patients were supposed to be getting was what they were leaving with. And I did not find any errors where patients were leaving with different medicines. What I did find was that there were 4 times when medications were given that were not written in the chart. So, for example, a patient had been diagnosed with something and they received treatment for that, but in addition, they may have left with iron, even though there wasn't necessarily a diagnosis of anemia written in the chart. So charting and increasing communication is an area that we can work on. Another part was asking patients to explain to me how they were going to take their medications. And 118 out of 122 patients were able to tell me what they were, how they were going to take their pills. The last part I looked at was with the diabetes subset of patients, which I'll talk about in a little bit. I asked them about their signs and symptoms of hypoglycemia, and 12 of the 16 patients were correctly able to identify three signs of hypoglycemia. So I think we have a little bit of work to do in that area. We work really hard to keep our prices low, and patients are asked to pay a small fee for their consult, and they also pay for their medications and their testing material. And so as I was looking at affordability, the average cost to each patient was $3.07, and this is just a chart that shows how many patients paid less than $2, $2 to $3, $4 to $5. Patients who are not able to pay for their medications or their consult are still, we use an emergency fund to pay for those patients so that they don't leave without treatment. And then there are an increasing number of patients who actually pay more than we ask, kind of keep the change or use this to help somebody else who's not able to pay for their medications. In order to look at effectiveness, I did follow-up calls to talk with the patients and see how they were doing. And just to point out here, this is effectiveness based on patient perceptions, not like if somebody had a UTI, we didn't go back and test to see that they did not have any more symptoms of a UTI. This is based on what their, whether or not they felt that their health needs were addressed. And so I broke this down into acute and chronic conditions, and the vast majority in both categories said that they felt like they got better based on the care that they received at the clinic. So I did a further analysis of that 12% that somewhat disagreed or strongly disagreed with saying that they got better after going to the clinic. And so that corresponded to 8 patients. 3 had been referred to another healthcare provider at the initial time. 1 of them did not take their medications. 2 were treated for malaria, no longer having fevers, but they had something else going on. 1 patient had not finished her treatment for gonorrhea and chlamydia, and there was 1 patient with conjunctivitis that said that the medication had no effect on his issue. Additionally, I forgot to do a slide on this one, but I also asked if they had sought care elsewhere. Did you have to go somewhere else after being seen by the health promoter? And 6 patients reported that they did go elsewhere. 2 were referrals. 1 was the rectal bleeding, and 1 was the rule-out appendicitis. And so, yes, they sought care elsewhere. 1 patient had Shigella and sought supportive measures from a traditional healer in their community as well. 1 malaria patient, who was among these 2, went to the health department and received treatment for her cough. And there were 2 diabetics that went to a physician as well. 1 of those diabetics told me that the physician told him he should be taking an additional sulfonylurea at bedtime. And so after he woke up, quote unquote, feeling drunk for 3 mornings in a row, he came back to the clinic where the health promoter explained to him why taking a sulfonylurea at bedtime was not a very good idea. So in the previous section, I was looking at effectiveness based on patient perceptions. And I looked at the diabetic patients who came in on those clinic days as a way to look more objectively at the effectiveness in this population. So there were 23 diagnosed diabetics in this study. Only 13 were included in this analysis for the reasons listed here. I was trying to look at how are we doing with diabetics who are in control, who were seen regularly, and who are taking their medications. One thing to point out that none of my days that I went to the clinics were our diabetes days. So these are not patients that are being seen regularly at the monthly diabetes days at each clinic. Our actual population of diabetics is much higher. We believe it's around 500 diabetics that we're seeing throughout the whole area. So this chart shows the diabetics. The second column is the years that they've been in control at the clinic. Let's see, here we go. This is their initial blood sugars. This is the average over the previous 6 months. And then these are the treatment. This is what they're receiving on a daily basis. I didn't break it down by how many times a day patients are taking their medication. One patient I wanted to point out, patient number 85 down here, is one who, she has been a diabetic for more than 10 years and is pretty close to maxed out on oral medication, and been talking to her for months and months about going on to insulin, which she is not willing to do, and so see that higher blood sugar there. So I know that some of these numbers are fairly good and some of them aren't great in terms of diabetes control, but there are a couple of things that I'd like you to keep in mind as you look at these numbers. Most of these patients wouldn't be able to get care elsewhere because there are very few options for low-cost, high-quality care for diabetics in Pitten. Without glucometers in their homes and doing frequent blood sugar checks, we have to be really careful also about the level of control that we're trying to provide, especially with the sulfonylureas and insulin, because we don't want to bottom patients out. And this was the average cost for the diabetics specifically. This includes their testing material, the cost of the consult, and 1 month of medication. This cost also included all of the other medications that patients are taking when they have secondary diagnoses as well. And so I did a chart here. You can see that many of the diabetics were also treated for, there's fungal infection, UTI, hypertension. So I've also listed the other medications off to the side that they received that went into that cost. All of the chronic meds for hypertension are also 30-day treatments, which is the increments that we give out. So the average cost was $549. So in this last section, I looked at the patient perceptions of the care that they're receiving. I asked this question just because I was curious about how many patients kept coming back to the clinic and how many were new patients. And then I asked them why they came to our clinic as opposed to seeking care elsewhere, and this was the most common reasons that were given in the percentage. I also asked them about patient satisfaction, which we hear a lot about in evaluating healthcare services. And the top one is, I asked this question right after they had seen the health promoter, and then I also did it again in the follow-up 1 to 3 weeks later, because I wanted to see if we were getting the same kind of answers. So it's really difficult for me as I look at these results to think about how to exactly interpret them, because they're so overwhelmingly positive. And so I tried to probe a little bit deeper there whenever there was something that I was unclear about exactly what the patient was saying. One woman, it was her first time at the clinic, and I was unsure about her answer, and I said, so you're saying that you somewhat agree with this, that you were satisfied with the care that you received? And she looked at me and she said, no. She said, I've never seen anything like this before. She said, I went in and she listened to me. And she listened. And then she asked questions. And she listened some more while I explained. And then she explained to me what was happening in my body. She told me what the medications were going to do. She told me what I needed to do. And she said, it was like she really cared about me. I've never had anything like this before. She said, no, I was highly satisfied with the care that I received. I also asked all of the patients for suggestions. How could we improve the services? Once again, trying to get at the negatives. And 11 patients did have suggestions, mostly related to being open more days, having more healthcare providers, or having other kinds of equipment. But more often, I received more affirmations. Patients who said, it's perfect the way it is. They took very good care of me at the clinic. Please don't change anything. It's magnificent, and I'm very thankful for the care that I received. So most of my experience in nursing has been in a small country in a far-off corner of the world, and maybe a lot of what I do is not transferable to your particular settings. But we've worked on a program which provides safe, effective, affordable healthcare services, and so I've tried to identify some of the principles which I think may be transferable. Evidence-based practice is incredibly important in our setting, but we really work hard at making it applicable. So, for example, of course, more glucose readings more frequently could help us to increase our glycemic control of our patients, our diabetic patients. But if the cost of that is that we can't see as many patients, then how do we weigh the cost-benefit there? And so those are some of the questions that we grapple with as we're working at how to transfer evidence-based practice into our study. Peer-to-peer relationships are something really amazing there that I don't quite understand. Patients will tell things to health promoters that they will never say to me, and health promoters can talk to patients in a way that I don't either. There was an advanced course once in which one of my coworkers was giving a course to the multipliers, and she was talking about heavy metal poisoning, and somebody brought up a case, and she said, wait, I saw that patient. And she did seem like she had heavy metal poisoning, but I asked and asked and asked, and I couldn't determine where it was coming from. And the health promoter said, well, it was probably the mercury vitamins that the patient was taking. And I'm not going to go into the mercury vitamins. But my coworker Susan said, what do you mean mercury vitamins? She didn't tell me she was taking mercury vitamins. And Marina said, well, of course she's not going to tell you. That's what you've got us for. She said, the patient will never tell you all of the things that they're taking, but they will talk to us. And I think of that example often and thinking about how health promoters are able to relate to patients on a different level. And the third point is empowerment. We talk a lot about empowerment in healthcare, and I think it's really difficult because it implies us as health professionals relinquishing some of our power. And I think that sometimes can make us uncomfortable. But until people become more empowered to be active participants in their healthcare, I believe that we're going to continue to be frustrated with outcomes. And so I thank you for your time and your attention, and I look forward to questions and comments.
Thank you very much for the presenters. And now it's time for us to ask questions, and I would like to invite all the speakers to hear. And so anyone has any questions?
Question about the healthcare models in Russia. I enjoyed all these presentations of the great camp and the things around the world. What's happening with screening? Is there breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening, prostate cancer screening, things like that?
No, not really. There isn't. For example, St. Petersburg is a city of 5 million, and they only have like two mammography machines. So it's used for diagnostics and not screening, which is unfortunate because the WHO has noted that they have the highest oncological rate compared to Western Europe, mm-hmm. Eastern Europe, because most of the energy is nuclear energy and mm-hmm. they're leaking. Some of you probably remember Chernobyl,
yeah.
But because it's under the government, you know, and the government's put money elsewhere. Mm-hmm.
And I want to follow up also for the Russian question. You know, the machines that they're using, what's the evidence-based practice component of that? They look very old, and is it just a traditional treatment, or do they do research studies to look at effectiveness, et cetera?
Of some of the physiotherapy?
Yeah.
Maybe in Moscow, you know, they probably have updated machines. Maybe there's research being done there, but no, it's just mostly that the patients say it helps, and they'll just come for it. So there really isn't any hard evidence that they help. But the nursing student who had that done, she said it cleared her right up, and, you know, so, you know, that's what they go by is, you know, what the patients tell them.
So it could be a placebo effect.
It could be, yeah.
I just wanted to ask about Scotland and any privacy when you consider that the school records go to the police.
Yeah, they said because it's all government, health is government, police is government, school is government, but it doesn't seem to be as big of an issue there. Yeah. Good question, though. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a question for the Guatemala. I'm wondering if you could talk a little more about it.
I think that has a lot to do with it. I mean, comparing, you know, the services that the health promoters provide with professional services in the country, there's a huge gap, a social gap between the classes and the type of patients that we're seeing and the physicians and nurses, where it's a very, very different culture from healthcare, even that we see here now, in terms of physician has all the answers and they tell you what to do. So yeah, I think that in a large part it was a reaction to that, to what patients have seen in other areas. In Guatemala? I would think so, yeah.
I really enjoyed the talk you presented on behalf of someone else. Thank you. You did a great job.
Thank you.
It's so interesting about identifying some of the practices that we once see as helpful, like avoiding fruits and vegetables during the postpartum period. And do you have any suggestions on how to have that conversation where the Western view is that it's not healthy and that fruits and vegetables would be important during postpartum periods, but yet it doesn't go along with the culture? Any suggestions for making that bridge?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think maybe we could suggest, you know, these postpartum mothers and about taking their vegetables or, you know, put into the soup, because they usually after the postpartum, women are supposed to eat a lot of soups in order to have enough milk for the baby. So we could recommend them to put the vegetables into the soup and to cook it, and in that way it's still hot and it's not, you know, raw. And so I think that may be a good suggestion. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. So you spoke about what the mothers do. Are there things they do with babies too, in considering the balance?
Yeah, and for the babies, it's still true that for the whole month, and usually a Chinese woman will not take the baby out, you know, like go outside, and they confine them at home. And so they still consider that not like get cold or wind, and it's very similar, but not that particularly. But most time they usually also don't give a bath for the baby, and they can, you know, use the hot towel and to clean them, but not take a bath for the baby. Yes.
You mentioned that a lot of modern Chinese women don't follow those guidelines. But I'm wondering, is it different for those living in this country versus still living in China?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of differences, and also depends on like where you are, like in China, where you live in the cities or in the rural areas, but still people would like to stay at home, not go outside. But like we have a lot of nurses when I worked in that hospital, and after delivery, every nurse took a shower. And, you know, they said, well, they just don't believe it, they cannot stand it. So, you know, it's really, it depends on how, you know, how you believe it, and also where you live, and also the condition of the places you're living.
Well, you know, I have a Chinese friend, I don't see her very often anymore, but a lot of the old beliefs, even though she was educated in England and she's lived here most of her adult life, there were certain cultural practices that, you know, she did believe in. So.
Yeah, I think so, because I think basically most women believe that, you know, after the postpartum, after delivering the baby, during this 1 month, if you use cold water or drink cold water, and then you will have a stomach ache and a headache, or, you know, aches all over your body for the rest of your life. So they are just afraid of like breaking these rules and to get, you know, all these chronic pains in the rest of their life. Yeah, I think that's the strong belief. It's also based on the traditional Chinese medicine, yin and yang. Yeah.
I know we have a close friend, a colleague, who, though she may not have chosen as an individual to follow these practices, she's very connected to a Chinese community, and she very much felt the social pressure to adhere to that. And so I think that's an important consideration, too, that depending on the social context. And there was a real tension because she felt very uncomfortable with any of us coming to visit her because she hadn't washed her hair, hadn't taken a shower. So that was a very interesting situation as well.
Yeah.
In the social context, she very much felt that she needed to adhere to that.
And also we have a nurse who married to a Chinese guy, and the nurse is American, and she presented with me about like in our cultural class about China, and she talked about when she delivered a baby, her mother-in-law and would come to the hospital to visit her, but she has to hide all this cold water, all the food they consider as cold, and in front of her mother-in-law, because her mother-in-law would not let her to eat all this kind of food. Yeah.
I think it's very interesting, the beliefs, because they're very similar to Central America as well. Mm-hmm. So just much of what you said, the hot and cold air, very similar practices. So, you know, those kinds of things can be translated to other countries as well.
Do the women breastfeed?
Traditionally, yes, but for like right now, I don't think the breastfeeding rate is that high, because most women after 6 months they will go to work, but they still feel that you know, it's too much for them to breastfeed the baby, so still nursing. You know, care is still trying to educate mother for breastfeeding, and breastfeeding rate actually is very low in China.
Question about nursing students or other students visiting other places for you, Jeanette. With your promoters doing so much of the hands-on practice, you know, many nursing schools would like to take students to do sort of a health experience. What's appropriate in your setting?
We do have groups, both professionals and student groups, that come occasionally to visit the work, and we really try to make it an exchange of ideas and skills and knowledge, and so depending on the skill level of the, you know, if it's a student, they may not be doing as much hands-on care with some of the professionals. They'll tend to work side by side with the health promoter, sharing ideas, but we really try not to take away from what the health promoters are doing, but rather to look for ways to enhance that. So sometimes we'll ask student groups to teach something, like do a presentation with the health promoters and teach them something. And then in addition, they're observing and seeing what the health promoters are doing in their practice. And then it's just very individual, but we look for ways to try to make it an exchange of ideas and not just one or the other showing the other person how to do it.
Any other questions?
And on a follow-up, but kind of related to that, in Russia, what are the student experiences that you're incorporating for that two-week period that you're saying you're bringing students there?
Okay, I take senior-level undergraduate students, and it counts like for 40 hours of their practicum course, and they work in the clinic. I also take a nurse practitioner student with a faculty. So the nurse practitioner is doing the physicals, and then the students are doing the screening types of activities. And I've done research there on the metabolic syndrome. So, you know, they do blood pressures, and we bring a glucometer. We have brought a cholesteric machine before, so we'll check some of those kind of values. And then the students do teaching projects. They have to prepare a teaching project. And because that's not typically done in Russia, the women or the people really appreciate it. I know that we did it once for pregnant women, and they talked about after how nice it was to just be together and to talk and to share their, hear something and then to share their experiences. So they're very open to that, and it's beginning, and it's just slow.
Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, well, and before we close, I just would like to let you know that I serve as the associate editor for the Frontiers in Epidemiology, which is an open access journal, and they have Frontiers in Public Health, and we welcome all of you to, you know, send your articles to me and submitted to that journal. Is the open access peer-reviewed journal, and we do publish a lot of articles conducted by our studies or review articles by our nurses.
Yeah. What was the name of the journal?
Frontiers in Epidemiology or Frontiers in Public Health. So it's open access but peer-reviewed international interdisciplinary journal. Yeah.
And then I'd like to add, if any of you are interested in getting involved, the Global Health Committee of the Public Health Nurse Section, we have a meeting today at 2 o'clock at the Westin. I'm going to try to get a table for us at the restaurant there on the first floor, and you're welcome to come and join us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would also like to say, if anybody wanted more information about Concern America, there's a little bit here, including job openings.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.